You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
When one's ego is in control, we can be very self-centered and tend to ignore the needs of others in the community. Being empathetic and compassionate with acts of kindness and gratitude will help to keep your self-importance in check. More we, less me.
This story is about a spiritual community led by G.I. Gurdjieff in France. People paid to live in the community and to learn from him. Among the community was a very difficult old man. He was irritable, messy, always fighting with the other people, and unwilling to do his share of the work. Nobody liked him, and he did not like the group. After many months of struggling to stay with the group, the old man left for Paris. Gurdjieff went after him and tried to get him to come back, but the old man said no, it had been too hard. Finally, Gurdjieff offered to pay him a large monthly stipend if he returned. What could the old man do? He agreed to come back. Well, when the rest of the people heard that he was paying this miserable old cuss to stay in the community, when they themselves were being charged a handsome fee to stay there, they were up in arms. Gurdjieff called them together and said, "Look, this man is like yeast for bread. Without him, you would never really learn about anger, irritability, patience, and compassion. That is why you pay me. And that is why I hire him."
All right, first of all, relax. That story's not code. None of you are the old cuss. I am certainly not Gurdjieff. But it's a reading I come back to when I experience the normal frustrations that arise from being part of an intentional spiritual community like this. It reminds me what spiritual direction really is. Learning to love each other better, and to love the world better through the discipline of actually living our principles together. Intentional spiritual communities, in other words, are about upgrading people like you and me into better versions of ourselves, like that. And any change, even a change to love each other better, must involve some discomfort. If you haven't felt any discomfort, you've not been challenged to change. And if you've not been challenged to love more abundantly, this place ain't doing what it's meant to. But you can't make people change, can you? Just like you can't make people join. We are a free church, so any form of coercion is the exact opposite of what we're about. That's why membership in a place like this is not and never should be the price of fellowship. And that's why we don't chase you to become formal members. If you miss a few services, no one's going to ring and creepily ask, "We haven't seen you for a while. Is everything okay, man? Don't you love us anymore?" A free church means if you engage and how you engage, it's by free consent. If we respect people's freedom and autonomy, that's as it should be. But freedom, that kind of freedom, requires maturity in both the individual and in the collective. And this is hard, and so it won't be for everyone. The story that Mary read is silent on how many people left Gurdjieff's community as a result of his keeping that old cuss. But truthfully, isn't there a little bit of that irascible old cuss in each of us from time to time? In you. In me. All of which begs the question, why bother joining such a difficult place at all? I mean, all you get from membership is a voice and a vote, and thus the opportunity maybe to help run the joint. And most people, frankly, have enough trouble in their lives without getting mixed up in small-time politics. Most just want to cherry-pick the good stuff without having to be the ones who provide the good stuff. That's normal. But, you know, there is no moral credit and no change required by being a choosy consumer. We're already choosy consumers. So maybe financial membership itself as an objective, a goal of a church, has had its day. Because when you think about it, there are so many other options for engagement now. I mean, you can get good Unitarian stuff via the Church of the Larger Fellowship, which is essentially an online church. There are literally thousands of YouTube services and live stream services, and there are bajillions of podcasts. In fact, we here, too, have a shadow congregation we never see and never will see. People who engage with us through our many media iterations, our podcasts, our TV, social media, and the website. Did you know, by the way, that our SA Unitarians Facebook page has 376 people following it? How many do you think are in the room right now? Not many. They're far and wide, and yet they stay connected with us without joining or attending. So what? Do we send them membership forms? We do not. Does their engagement not matter, then? Well, it must. But most churches haven't worked out how to respond to the cultural shifts enabled by telecommunication technology. And if you're interested in how churches are failing to respond to this and how they might, you might want to see next month's newsletter. I've got a little message about that, how ministry's changed in the last 10 years. If you have not formally joined this church as a member, paying your subs and getting a voice and a vote and some chance for petty authority, and there's no need to do any of that, why do we have a formal membership process and structure at all? Why should you not continue just to be a permanent guest in this house rather than one of the hosts? Well, dig this. There is something very important to be gained and very important to be lost by formally committing to a collective, challenging as that is sometimes. How may we become better versions of ourselves by making such a commitment? We gave you a negative example earlier with that story. Here's another negative example. Do you remember the cautionary fairy tale of the world's worst house guest, Goldilocks? You probably remember it as a story about the dangers of naive curiosity or something like that. Forget that. Forget that. That story has been misinterpreted for centuries and sanitized from its original folk version. It is actually a story of how Goldilocks's individualism and sense of personal entitlement fails to recognize the deep value of life in community. Because the real heroes of the story are the bears. And its misreading is mainly due to our civilized bias against bears. I mean, after all, they're big, they're scary, they're carnivorous, they're wild animals. And of course, by contrast, Widow Goldilocks gets our maudlin sympathy for children alone in the uncivilized woods. But in the ancient times the story originated in, folks understood bears' observable habits of clannishness and hibernation and regarded them as spirit animals, avatars of clan home and hearth. When you know that, Goldilocks comes off as a brazen, ravening little squatter. Consider, she's not happy with her own company. Obviously, she's been alone in the woods a while and is no doubt lonely and maybe a little bored. So rather than passing by the house, as you would do if you were fine with your own company, she seeks out company. The unlocked door she finds is taken by her not as welcome openness and invitation to share home and hearth, but as an opportunity to rip the joint off. To enjoy food and creature comforts she's not made herself. Now, this is nothing to do with a thou shalt not steal simplistic moralizing. The bears leaving the door open shows they don't begrudge the house's use in their absence. This was more normal than today, this ancient tradition of allowing strangers to be welcome in your place. Strangers. It's worth remembering that every person sitting here today began as a stranger to each other. Didn't they? Didn't you? Had the bears been home when Goldilocks arrived, there's no reason to believe they would not have offered the hospitality of food, furnishings, and fellowship. And you know the tripartite structure of the story, right? You know, she destroys the just right chair from over-enthusiasm, since you never value what you don't sacrifice for, right? Then the just right porridge quickly vanishes because she's hungry, and so to bed, but not before disordering all the other beds until she finds the bed that's just right, which is where the bears find her after following her trail of consumer destruction. When she wakes and sees them, there are lots of courses of action open to her. She might, well, thank them. She might offer to make the beds, maybe fix the chair, do the washing up. But instead, she leaps out the window and runs off alone into the woods whence she came, alone again. Naturally. Ever wonder what happened to Goldilocks after she ran off? My theory for the sequel, Goldilocks Part 2, is that she went feral. Well, remember, she was all about getting everything right for me, me, me. She most likely cuts herself off from others, learns to forage, grows haggard and rather mad, and that special madness, the truly isolated, can be mad. Talking to herself, talking to toadstools and stumps, maybe baying nights at the cold and lonely moon. And what might the bears have said to her had she not run off? The hospitable bears, the clannish home and hearth bears, may have been puzzled. Not that she entered and used up things in the home, but that she managed to make her continued comfort and welcome more difficult through her fussy obsession with control and entitlement. Finding the just right chair, she used it up. Finding the just right porridge, she ate it up. Finding the just right bed, she falls into a helpless and unguarded sleep, and so wakes in fright and runs off alone and unprovided for back into the woods, leaving, as you'll recall, Baby Bear to weep that she hadn't stayed to play. Old folk tales, like our children's story time, can hopefully be read differently at different ages. The traditional Goldilocks story appeals chiefly to preschoolers who are engaged in cleanliness training, maintaining environmental and behavioral order, and about their distress at the disruption of cleanliness and order. So aligning with Goldilocks signals a lack of emotional maturity. As we mature, people tend to align themselves more with the tidy, organized, ursine protagonists than with the unruly, delinquent human antagonist. The story provides a negative example of the childish, selfish, mess-making consumer individualism by which we live and offers a better alternative in an admittedly unlikely, hairy guise. What we gain by committing to a clannish collective we are in sympathy with is important. What we lose by committing to such a collective is also important. What we stand to lose is our individualism. What we stand to gain is a more mature individuality. These should not be confused. As an alternative to individualism, individuality celebrates the very real differences between people. The bears, remember, in their clannish closeness, all have different requirements. You know, for the father, the porridge is hot, for the mother, the porridge is cold, and so on. And the beds are hard or soft. So there are very real differences between people without denying their fundamental interdependence. While individualism, represented by Goldilocks, understands a person as a separate entity dependent on no one. Individuality recognizes that each of us, varied as we are, have to exist within a mutuality, a shared fate, a collective responsibility. Now, intentional spiritual communities like Gurdjieff's was, and like ours is meant to be, have an organizing mission and covenant. And these remind us of the responsibilities that come with an affirmation of interdependence. Our faith asks us to shift from individualism to a shared belonging as individuals to one another in community and to a larger mission. In short, it is an invitation to the power of we rather than the power of me. But church community struggles because it exists in and is shaped by now the wider culture of consumerism. And that wider culture frames how we think about church. Church easily falls into the broader pattern of our other consumer behaviors of expectation, entitlement, demand, complaint, and rejection. The consumerist dream is that our freedom to choose means that we can, and have a right to, order the world for our convenience alone, like Goldilocks, to have everything just right for each individual us. And the reason community organizations are struggling as never before is that the consumerist ethos we take for granted is fundamentally incompatible with community. Fundamentally incompatible. Church has stood for centuries as an alternative to mercantile culture. Church communities are especially incompatible with a consumer mindset. And free churches like ours are even more especially incompatible with a consumer mindset. You can think about it. How can things be just right for each and everybody if everybody is free to pursue different things, want different outcomes, and feel entitled to demand them and raise a ruckus if they don't get exactly what they want? Some like it hot, some like it cold, some like it in their church pot 3 centuries old. Some want spiritual growth, some want social justice action, some want an escape from the world, some just want their hand held. Every one of our 100 members has a personal Goldilocks zone, a just right. But there can be no sweet spot where all these just rights meet. It's impossible. How do we remain free individuals and yet stay together as a collective? Well, the answer is by covenanting to meet each other's needs. And there are copies of our church covenant, which I have strategically placed on your pews today. If you haven't read it, it'd be a good idea to read one. If you haven't read it in a while, it's an excellent time to reread it. Human beings do need community as much as they need food and shelter. Maslow's hierarchy says so. And the withdrawing tide of community living in society at large is responsible for much of social and psychological problems that crowd our headlines and news bulletins. Churches, by the way, are perhaps the last community organizations to remain standing in the receding tide of community organizations. We can remember how community's done. But community is something you have to build and maintain with others, with others. It means being responsible to see that not just your just rights, but others' just rights can be met too. Community, especially church community, is not a shop. It's more like, and I hesitate to say this, a family, except you get to freely choose this family. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the great theologian, said the church is where you find yourself sitting next to someone you'd probably never have had anything to do with otherwise. Does church therefore mean a degree of tension, discomfort, and contention, as with any family? I mean, show me the family that doesn't. Of course it does. Will you find members of this clan rather trying and awkward at times? Yes. But church also offers a chance for all members to develop a Christ-like care for those you find hardest to care for. Maybe this is why we're no longer the Christian Church, Unitarian Christian Church of South Australia, because that fundamental ethic of loving people you find hard to love has proven too damn hard for many people. But where is the moral credit for caring only for those you like? Do not even the Pharisees do as much? No. If we would be a church, we are called to love people, period, not to inquire whether they're worthy of love. Church community, like any family, is a place where everything doesn't have to be just right, but where things are sort of all right, nevertheless. It's a place where our challenges can be shared, our burdens divided, our joys multiplied. Here we may find that rarest of commodities, a belonging that doesn't have to do with mercenary work environments or class or spendings of money. Indeed, no money can buy community, which is maybe one of the reasons we've learned not to value it. All religious wisdom points in that one direction, growing out of the egocentricity of our culture and that our old brains dispose us towards. Committing to community is just a first step out of the self and toward what might be called ethnocentricity, identifying a larger, more inclusive group, a family, a tribe, a clan, like the Bears. In short, any community offers an opportunity to step from an infantile me consciousness to a more mature we consciousness, something dear Goldilocks couldn't bear. You can do the pun, by the way, is the lowest form of humor. It's, he who would pun would pick a pocket. You can do this with any communal group, but identification only with your self-selected group is also a trap. It can lead to tribalism and exclusivity. You know, the our team rules, your team sucks mentality. No, the end game cannot be identification with the clan alone, and this is where church community is different and vital. For not until the individual's identity expands beyond the we consciousness of the clan or tribe to include a care and concern for all others, regardless of their awkwardness or their race or their color or their creed or their gender or their sexual orientation or beliefs or opinions, only when our concern expands that far is our spiritual development anything like maturing. This last stage is what we might call a world-centric stage of spiritual development. This is what church communities can offer and what diverse Unitarian churches can uniquely foster, because the world-centric aspiration is our guide, our direction, and compass. Yes, and at the risk of sounding boosterish, I mean, I feel like the local sales rep for this faith down here in Australia, what makes Unitarian churches rather special is that we have abandoned silly, divisive, doctrinal battles about unknowable things in order to share a clear-eyed commitment to the fluid, open, collective work of seeking spiritual growth together. Without insisting, we all share the same idea of what the spiritual life looks like. That is going to be messy. Our freedom makes for a messy faith. But in undertaking this messiness, we are not just never alone, but part of something greater than ourselves, greater even than this one church. So why not join this clan formally? See, I got the plug in for membership. Is Unitarianism, is this Unitarian church just right for you? Time will tell and things change. But I urge you who come to this place as a member or not to seek less what is just right for you and with us in fellowship seek what is just right. To join us on a journey from me to we. So, my friends, to paraphrase the late John F. Kennedy, do of course ask what your church can do for you. We expect that. But also ask what you can do for your church and together ask what our church can do, for in that call to transform, do we become spiritually mature and truly free, and that is what's just right. Amen. this be a church where side by side in friendship and goodwill, we build a place where all can be respected and fulfilled. Amen. And have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitariansa@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.